From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with actor Michael J. Fox about his relationship with the camera. He grew up in front of it on sitcoms, but when he started a family of his own, the paparazzi wouldn't get out of his way. Fox stars in the new movie For Love or Money, which opens this week. Also today, a controversial stand against pornography. Lawyer Catherine McKinnon says pornography has more protection than women do. She's co-written controversial ordinances that would outlaw pornography that subjugates women. She'll tell us why she thinks the First Amendment should not protect pornography. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Pentagon said today that 600 American troops will be sent to Haiti beginning next week to help retrain the Haitian military. The statement said the troops will include engineers and doctors as well as military trainers. Some of the troops will work on projects to rebuild roads, bridges, and buildings, including military barracks. The Pentagon said the troops are part of a planned six-month United Nations operation and will be fulfilling a non-confrontational role. An advance team of U.S. troops will arrive in Port-au-Prince next week. President Clinton said today that he stands by Commerce Secretary Ron Brown's assertion that he did nothing wrong when he met with a Vietnamese businessman. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
A grand jury is investigating allegations that Brown accepted $700,000 from a Vietnamese businessman in exchange for working towards lifting the U.S. trade embargo against Vietnam. Brown admits to meeting with the businessman, knew Nguyen Van Hau, three times. But Brown's lawyer said Brown never agreed to represent Hau in business dealings between the U.S. and Vietnam. Today, the White House press secretary, Dee Dee Myers, said that the president accepted Brown's explanation that he did nothing improper. The president stands by him, Myers said. According to Myers, Brown told the president that he never discussed money with the Vietnamese businessman and that he never participated in meetings where administration officials discussed lifting the embargo against Vietnam. 2 weeks ago, Clinton relaxed the embargo so that U.S. companies could, for the first time, bid on development projects in Vietnam funded by international financial institutions. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas has canceled a scheduled appearance this Friday at the National Convention of the Concerned Women of America. The conservative group strongly supported Thomas's nomination to the Supreme Court. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Thomas had agreed to appear at the convention this Friday, and the Concerned Women for America billed his appearance as a speech from the heart that would not be open to the press. Thomas has at least twice before made appearances at conservative events, once earlier this year when he spoke at a fundraising event put on by a conservative organization in Atlanta, and once shortly after his confirmation when he appeared on a TV show beamed to conservative activists around the country. On that occasion, Thomas thanked viewers for their support. This time, though, as questions mounted about his scheduled appearance, the justice referred the matter to the Supreme Court's legal officer and was told in a legal opinion that his scheduled appearance would appear to violate the standards of judicial conduct and would create the appearance of impropriety. Justice Thomas then canceled his appearance. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost a point and a half to close at 3,566. This is NPR News. The Justice Department said today that 1,500 Cuban inmates in U.S. prisons will be sent home under a repatriation agreement with Cuban authorities. The prisoners are former refugees who came to the United States as part of the 1980 Mariel boatlift and later committed serious crimes in this country. Those to be sent home are Cubans who've completed their U.S. prison sentences but are still in jail because they've been declared deportable. They make up about a third of the 4,500 Cubans currently held in American prisons. Reports from Israel say Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin met privately on Sunday with Jordan's King Hussein. Both men are denying the meeting took place. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
The speculation began when Prime Minister Rabin canceled several public appearances Sunday night and disappeared. The next morning, several Israeli newspapers reported he may have met King Hussein in the Jordanian port of Aqaba. Rabin's office said he attended a secret army training exercise, and a spokesman for the king also denied the meeting. But the rumors persisted today, and the usually reliable military correspondent of the Haaretz newspaper, Zev Schiff, said the two met on a boat near Aqaba. King Hussein has repeatedly met Israeli leaders secretly, but only the heads of Egypt and Morocco have publicly met Israeli officials. Israel hopes that the agreement between Israel and the PLO will lead to diplomatic relations with Arab countries besides Egypt. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The maker of Keds sneakers has agreed to pay $7.2 million to settle a nationwide price-fixing suit. The suit was brought by New York Attorney General Robert Abrams and ultimately joined by all 50 states, the District of Columbia, and the Federal Trade Commission. Officials allege that Keds fixed prices on 5 million pairs of women's sneakers and that the price-fixing cost consumers an average of about a dollar a pair. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Michael J. Fox, stars in a new movie opening this weekend called For Love or Money. It's a romantic comedy directed by Barry Sonnenfeld, who also directed The Addams Family. Fox plays a concierge in a pricey New York hotel. He knows the city inside out and, for the right price, can get anything a guest could ask for. Fox is, of course, best known for his role as Alex Keaton on Family Ties and for the Back to the Future movies. I told him I really admired some of the choices he's made in his career. In addition to commercial comedies, he's done complex dramatic films like Brian De Palma's Casualties of War, set in Vietnam, and Paul Schrader's Light of Day, a movie about a brother-sister rock band co-starring Joan Jett.
I'm proud of those choices, and I'm proud of those movies. I wish that I could take credit for some kind of grand vision and say, well, yeah, you know, I felt it. It was good to have this juxtaposition, and well, I really didn't. I read scripts, and I said, wow, really? I can do this? You'll let me? Terrific.
Now, why do you think they sent you the scripts? Because you were known as a comic actor, and these were both dramas, and I know, like in Hollywood, there's so much typecasting. Why do you think they thought of you?
It's hard to get into the minds of other people.
Yeah, right.
It's really
probably
hard,
especially in Hollywood, right?
Especially in Hollywood, and you don't even want to go there, and you don't want to go there alone. But I think there are a lot of different reasons, and a lot of people have different agendas. Sometimes it's purely commercial. People say, I would love to attach that name to my project, whatever its suitability, because it could bring a heightened return on my investment. I think that other people, you know, have a pure belief in your ability and say, yeah, this guy can do it. And they want to be the person that bets on the winning horse. They want to be the person that's right, you know, in that regard. And I think also some people are forced into it. And, you know, some people, you know, so any one
forced
of those...
Forced into it, like choose someone from the A-list?
Right, exactly. Yeah. And any one of those factions can be campaigning and lobbying. So as an actor, it does you no good in the long run to think about that.
I want to talk with you a little bit about your background. You grew up in Canada. Your father was in the Canadian Army, and then he was with the Edmonton Police?
Actually, the Delta Police in British Columbia. He was a dispatcher.
Oh, okay.
Which my father loved the police. He loved that lifestyle. He was too old to be an active policeman by the time he had finished his term in the service. But you know, he used to say his job was to say, "Go get 'em, boys." He really loved that.
So was he a disciplinarian at home?
He was in many ways, and yet in other ways he gave you a lot of room. You know, it was, you know, 1,700 hours, sit at the dinner table and don't be late and all that good stuff. But at the same time, this is a man who, when I was 17 years old, allowed me to drop out of high school because high school wouldn't give me room to do theater at night and to do the television work that I was doing. And my father's way of thinking was that from my socioeconomic background, it's not like I was going to the University of British Columbia and becoming a physiotherapist or, you know, or whatever. Or a lawyer. I mean, that wasn't going to happen. So in his way of thinking, if I was happy and I had found a vocation that interested me and I was getting a check, that he would do everything he could to support me. And in fact, my father drove me down to Los Angeles on his credit card, picked up the gas and all that stuff.
You were how old when you got Family Ties?
I was 20 years old.
20?
Yeah.
So how'd you get the part?
Well, that was a long, involved story. I was at this point destitute. I mean, I had...
Destitute or in debt? You're in debt, right?
I was both, yeah. I had no phone. I had no furniture. I was ducking the landlord. I was eating plain wrap macaroni and tuna, and I owed the IRS some money, and I was in a tough spot, and I knew that at that point, you know, it was time to go back to Canada, but I really felt that I could do something, and I said to my agent, because I had always resisted going in to read for sitcoms, but I said, you know, at this point, I'm so desperate, I'll do anything. Send me in for sitcoms, send me in for everything. And I went in and read for Family Ties. Gary Goldberg hated me, didn't want to see me again. Judith Wiener was insistent that he was missing the point with me. And after about 5 weeks, he had me come in again. And I read for him. Gary Goldberg is the executive producer. I read for him again, and immediately he became my champion. He took me to the network. He fought for me very hard because they were resistant. And then they hired me. We did the pilot. Brandon Tartikoff wanted to fire me again, said to Gary. And this was by Brandon's own admission. I didn't know this until several years later, and he kind of came to me and said, you want to know what an idiot I am? This is what I was trying to do, and you didn't even know about it. He had approached Gary and said, look, the kid's all right, but can you see his face on a lunchbox? And Gary said, well, you know, I'd never thought that was, you know, the criterion for you know, hiring actors. He said, look, Brandon, all I know is I write the kid 2 jokes. He gets me 3 laughs. You can't take this kid away from me. And so they kept me around, and ultimately it paid off.
The show is, I think, supposed to be about the parents first, you know, the hippie parents in the 80s, you know, 20 years later in the 80s. But the show ended up being more about you and Justine Bateman. How can you feel, when did you start to feel that change happening?
Well, almost from the beginning. When we did the pilot for Family Ties, I saw, not in anything that I was doing, but I saw in the character I just saw an energy and also a relevance I don't know, of this weird accessibility that I don't think many people saw. I said, well, I know these guys. I mean, I hang out at UCLA, and these guys exist, you know, much to my fear and my dread, that there was that wave, that whole Reagan youth thing starting to happen. And they had written a funny character, and they had written a lot of funny contradictions and a lot of ironies within this character. And so we did the pilot, and I kind of knew that he was, that if we went on, he would kind of start to move center stage. And it wasn't anything I was trying to manipulate or cause to happen. I just knew. And what I knew about writers was they will write to where the laughs are. And they will write for you know, the character that provides the most laughs. And again, I wasn't trying to step forward and do that. I just kind of knew, and I would know every week. And I would step back and I'd go, damn. I mean, they howled at that stuff. And next week, there'd be more lines and more lines. And it just kind of progressed from there.
Was it hard as you kept getting older for the character to still be at home and in high school? Because it took him a while to get to college.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was kind of weird at 27 to be saying, Mallory, get off the phone. You know? it was getting old, and we all knew it, you know. And that was one of the reasons, you know, it was, we all decided in the 7th season that was it, you know, that we couldn't really do anymore, that it wasn't fair. You know, I kind of felt like we were just taking people for a ride if we'd gone much beyond that. You know, it was, to me, the peak season, the best season of Family Ties will always be the 5th season. For a lot of reasons, it was the season that my wife now came on the show, and it was.
This is Tracy Pollan.
Tracy Pollan, yeah, and I think, you know, that's just when it, you know, kind of kicked to another level, and also it was we were then in the full swing of the whole kind of Back to the Future, Cosby Show, this whole thing that was happening. We were in this great time slot, and I had this whole other thing happening with a film career, and it just got into this other energy where we just. It was like that championship season, you know. It was just the year that it was great. And after that, we were kind of, you know, I think we were still doing a quality show, but, it, you know, that was its moment.
So did you and Tracy Pollan start to fall in love on the set?
We actually didn't. We were both involved in different relationships. I had a crush on her. There's no question of that. I thought she was unbelievable and such a good actress. And it wasn't until I did Bright Lights, Big City, and she read for it. And we had this conversation, and I said, you know, so how's it going with so-and-so? And she, you know, she said, well, we're not together anymore. And I was like, okay, let's have to, what do I do here? Okay, quick, you know, say something, say the right thing immediately. And it wasn't a year later that we were married.
It must be really awkward in a way to start developing a relationship with someone when you're working with them on a movie.
Right.
Do you try to keep it quiet from everybody
else? Yeah,
on set?
You try to do that whole thing. And then there's also the whole kind of, you know, tabloid level interest in what you do. And so you kind of have, you spend a lot of time, you know, running through Central Park, you know, away from photographers and just bizarre stuff. And you stop and go, why am I doing this? Why do I even care?
You actually wrote a really funny article in Esquire magazine about what it was like to get married with all the paparazzi and all the tabloids wanting to be part of the wedding and you wanting to keep them out.
Well, I had the good luck to have Michael Pollan as my brother-in-law, who's the executive editor at Harper's and a terrific writer. And just to kind of backtrack and set it up, we got married at this little inn in Vermont. And I've always understood that, you know, if people in the public eye get married and they have, you know, 14 elephants and, you know, camels and, you know, people, you know, you swing up on a golden, chandelier and, you know, and it costs $500,000, there's a certain amount of spectacle there. And you expect it to get some kind of coverage. And it would be hypocritical at that point to say, well, okay, leave us alone, you know.
It's just a little personal event.
But this was like 40 people at an inn in Arlington, Vermont.
Yeah.
And, you know, we literally had a record player and we, you know, rolled back the rugs and we had like jug wine and beer, you know. It was a pretty low-key deal. So when this giant contingent of the tabloid press showed up and demanded that their rights be served and that they get to, you know, they get to cover the event on behalf of our fans, I immediately said, well, anyone who would sanction this, I'm happily, you know, I won't take their money anymore. They can keep their $7. I don't need them. And it just was so hilarious. I mean, if it was just a little intrusive, I think I would have been more angry. But it was so kind of biblical. It was just insane.
Would you have helicopters?
Well, there were helicopters. There was one group of photographers that were trying to find a llama suit because there were llamas on the grounds of this inn, and they thought if they put on a llama suit, they could infiltrate. There were, these helicopters. There were people. They had the National Enquirer had their central command in the same hotel that where we spent our first night of marriage. You know, it was just insane. We were checking for parabolic microphones. It became so comic. When we went down to on our honeymoon down to the Caribbean, and we had this terrific villa on the water, and we arrived at night, and I'll never forget the morning that I woke up, and there was these big louvered windows, and I opened them up, you know, to look at the view, and there were three boats, 50 feet offshore, with like 500mm lenses, you know, pointed at us, and we went, this is surreal, and we went to Martha's Vineyard, and because we decided to escape that, and we went to Martha's Vineyard, and a frogman literally came out of the water and finally got the photograph that they've been trying to get. And then the capper to the whole thing was that we literally got bad reviews, that magazines like People and whatnot just savaged our wedding, just kind of not only said, how dare you, you know, try to get married and not have us be part of it, but also we hear it really sucked. We hear it was terrible, you know, and this projection, it was so clear, it was so adolescent, it was so, you know, this is just the most insane teenage projection that I've ever seen. And I sat back and I said, I don't even know how you rebut this, or whether you want to, or how you respond to it. And I was talking to Michael about it, and he said, write it, just write it down, because someone will want to hear it. And so it became this piece.
Something that interested me in the story, apparently when People magazine said, you know, if you give us the exclusive, you know, blah, blah,
right.
blah.
They said, they offered us the Bert and Lonnie deal. and we now see what happens when you take the Bert and Lonnie deal.
Well, what happens?
Well, you become partners. Well, you become partners with the media in the most private element of your life. And so, you know, with those people with Bert and Lonnie, who I don't know, and I perhaps shouldn't talk about them or be perceived to be making a judgment because I'm not really, but I mean, something's going on there. I mean, why else would you play this out to that extent in the press, the destruction of their marriage, if certain deals weren't made along the line. And you just can't make, you've got to, you know, I think the reason that I'm so happy is that I was always able to kind of keep a separation there. And sometimes it's difficult, and sometimes nasty things are said about you, and so, you know, whatever, but you have to kind of go, well, that's not real. I have to keep my world in some ways as small as possible.
It's part of the deal that if you let in a magazine and give them exclusive rights, they'll give you a good review for the wedding.
Basically,
and if you don't let them in, all bets are off.
That's essentially what happened, yeah. And like I said, the other thing that happens, I mean, like it really does become so juvenile and silly. I mean, to this day, I have, you know, back and forth with these people. I think currently I'm divorced in the latest Globe. And, you know, they call you and they say, you care to rebut this? And you say, no, read my lips. I'm not going to get in any confirmation denial relationship with you. I mean, what's the point? If I deny it, you'll characterize it as a, you know, this denial and you'll wrap it up. And, I mean, you know, it's like these things they do on A Current Affair where they videotape someone, and because nothing was said, what they do is they run it in slow motion so that it looks suspicious and nasty no matter what you do. It's just so insane that to even become party to it is just a waste of your time.
I love on those shows how they keep, since they only have like 3 inches of footage, they keep rerunning it over and over.
Right. And it's always that really slow motion thing with furtive little eye glance, you know. Taking out the trash, taking out the trash look like dumping bodies off the Brooklyn Bridge.
My guest is Michael J. Fox. He stars in the new romantic comedy For Love or Money. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael J. Fox. I want to ask you about Casualties of War, the film set in Vietnam, where you star with Sean Penn, and the platoon goes on this mission, and he basically kidnaps a young Vietnamese woman, midway through the mission, there's a gang rape that your character refuses to participate mm-hmm. in, and you try to save her. I'm interested in what it was like for you to work with Sean Penn, because you appear to be such different kinds of actors, and one would mm-hmm. think that you have really different approaches to, you know, how you prepare for a scene and what you're like in a scene when you're shooting. So I'm wondering if there's anything that clashed about that, or...
Well, there was actually no clash, but there was complete and total difference in the way we work.
Yeah.
When we finished the movie and we went out for dinner in Bangkok, and I gave Sean a gift, and there was a card, and I hope you won't mind me saying this, but on the card I had written, Sean, I can't say that it was a pleasure, but it was certainly a privilege, which is the way I felt about it. Sean and I have completely different approaches to the way we work, and I think that Sean is a tremendous actor with an amazing energy. And when we met originally and talked about doing the film together, you know, we're very open, and we kind of said what we were going to do. And Sean, as much as said, I am this guy. From the moment I get on the plane, I am this guy. And I said, I'm not, you know. So we kind of agreed to go our own ways in that way. And so that when we shot the film, and much has been made of this, but it actually was like a non-event. We, very little outside of working, talked very little and discussed what we were doing very little because it was counterproductive. There mm-hmm. was no sense in doing it. I like to work from the story out. From the story in to the character. And Sean prefers to look at it the other way. Having said that, what's really great about the way Sean worked is that he never once impinged upon anything, any choice I made with the way he did his work, which is to say, even though we played enemies, his approach to that is have minimal contact. A kind of an irresponsible approach to that style of work would be to be intrusive with my process in the way that his character might. And that would be irresponsible, and that I would, you know, go like this and say, wait a minute, you know, that's not the way it's going to work. and we've got to make some changes here. But it was never like that. Sean did his work, and I did my work, and I think that it worked well.
I have a friend who likes to say that that whole film kind of takes place on your face, because as the drama unfolds, as all these, as your character is exposed to all these horrors, your character is just changing and reacting to what he sees, mm-hmm. and what registers on your face is kind of crucial to right. what happens visually in the film. And I was wondering how conscious you were of that, and if it put, you know, different demands on you than anything you had done before.
Yeah, it was a very demanding film in that way. And again, you know, with comedy, I am most comfortable with comedy. And I think it's also because I have a real technical understanding of comedy. I mean, comedy, you can break it down. You can say, you know, you say things in threes, they're funny. If you hit the K, it's funny. Cucumber is funny. Certain things are funny. Dramatic moments and dramatic punchlines, if you will, are much more elusive, and it's much more just what happens. So you have to, I don't have a real technique for that. The only thing that I can do is be available to what's happening. The great thing about Casualties of War was, from a performance point of view, was that the environment was such, and the things that were being acted out were such, that that stuff was very available. I mean, this girl screaming was, I think, heightened by the fact that it was in Vietnamese and that we were all hot. It was 120 degrees. A lot of us were dysenteric. We were homesick. We had bites on us and welts. We had gone through basic training. We had done all these things. And so in that way, it was a real emotional experience. I found that when I felt the compulsion to act, I stifled it. I said, forget about it. I don't want to do that. Sean's performance, and rightly so, was a very outward and a very kind of forceful performance. And I thought that what Erickson should be is very quiet and very confused. He's not out there to push any agenda. He doesn't have an agenda. His agenda is just to get through this. He didn't know what to expect. He thought he was going on a camping trip. He just, you know, got a thing in the mail, said get on a plane and, you know, do this thing. And it's just... So I just thought, just sit back and let this stuff happen, and I think that it did, you know.
Well, one last question. Do you feel like you learned different things about yourself working with dramatic directors like Paul Schrader and Brian De Palma? About yourself as an actor.
I think that it's definitely those experiences were learning experiences for me as an actor. I think that also, given where they fell in my life, they were learning experiences for me as a person. I mean, I had never been exposed to anyone like Paul Schrader in my life, and I learned a lot about art and about acting and about life from him, and Brian as well. By the same token, I think I learn a lot about myself as an actor and as a filmmaker, in a sense, and a potential filmmaker in terms of directing, from Bob Zemeckis and from... you know, from Michael Caton Jones and Jonathan Lynn, who I just worked with as well. Just looking at the dramatic side isn't getting the entirety of any fact or any situation. That the comedic side can be as important and as fruitful if you explore it.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Michael J. Fox stars in the new movie For Love or Money. It opens this Friday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, a controversial crusader against pornography. We talk with lawyer Catherine McKinnon. She's proposed legislation outlawing sexually explicit material that subordinates women through pictures or words. She argues that the First Amendment shouldn't be used to defend pornography when pornography means the rape, dehumanization, and sale of women. McKinnon is a feminist, but many feminists and civil rights advocates regard her as an opponent of free speech. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Secretary of Defense Les Aspin told NPR today that there must be a clearly defined exit strategy before troops undertake any sort of peacekeeping mission in Bosnia. NPR's Martha Raddatz has that story.
Reflecting on the situation in Bosnia from his Pentagon office today, Secretary Aspin said that any commitment the U.S. makes to Bosnia or any peacekeeping operation that does not threaten national security should be a finite commitment, a fixed time period of involvement.
At the end of that time, the feeling would be that either the thing has taken and the peace is held and you can withdraw the peace enforcers or it won't, and in which case you probably ought to withdraw the peace enforcers anyway.
Asked specifically if the U.S. troops would be withdrawn at the end of the set time period even if the mission failed, the secretary indicated they would, saying somehow there's got to be an understanding that if there isn't peace and the sides want to continue fighting, we've got no business being there. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
At the UN, Russia's foreign minister has called for international help to help pay for Russian peacekeeping missions in the former Soviet Union. He called for the UN to grant Russian forces a mandate to take part in peacekeeping operations if all sides in a conflict request their presence. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
While Kozyrev's request is not new, the political context is. At present, rogue elements of the Russian army are supporting insurgents in the breakaway region of Abkhazia and fighting forces of Georgian leader Eduard Shevardnadze. This, despite a pledge by Moscow that it would play a neutral role in the dispute. The incident has raised suspicions of Russia's role and prompted fears that nationalist elements in the army could use a peacekeeping operation to stir up trouble in other parts of the former Soviet Union. But Kozyrev dismissed speculation that Moscow wants to create a neo-imperial Russia. He stressed the aim is to solve conflicts in the former Soviet Union through the UN. He also states that no other organization or group of states can replace a Russian peacekeeping role, suggesting the international community will have to rely on Russia, whether it wants to or not. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
In Venezuela, a natural gas pipeline explosion this morning killed at least 50 people. The explosion occurred during morning rush hour underneath a busy highway. Many of those killed were riding in a bus. The explosion occurred some 30 miles southwest of the capital, as flames destroyed at least 10 vehicles, including the bus. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 1.5 points to close at 3,566.02 on volume of more than 243 million shares. This is NPR News. In Moscow, CNN is reporting that more than 40 trucks have carried in Russian troops to a staging area near the parliament building. For 1 week now, hardline lawmakers have been camped out inside parliament in protest of Russian President Boris Yeltsin's move to dissolve parliament and call for new elections. Earlier today, police and army troops took part in a show of force outside of parliament, trying to break the stalemate. Government officials have ordered those inside to hand over their weapons and leave by tomorrow. A spokesman for Yeltsin has said that there are no plans to attack the building, but he has ruled out compromise with opponents. The Environmental Protection Agency has announced that it wants to fine the operators of 30 industrial furnaces, boilers, and incinerators across the country for violating federal hazardous waste law. NPR's Philip Davis reports.
Boilers and industrial furnaces are becoming one of industry's preferred ways of disposing of hazardous wastes like contaminated oil. Companies can just burn them, reducing the waste to small volumes of ash. But the process has to be carefully monitored, says EPA Administrator Carol Browner.
These facilities didn't know what they were burning. They didn't know what was coming in. A failure to monitor the air emissions. They didn't know what was coming out of the stack.
The 30 operations, some as big as Dow Chemical, could be fined as much as $19 million if the EPA wins lawsuits it filed against these firms. The action is meant to serve as a warning to other big industrial furnace operators that the EPA is cracking down on violators and to reassure communities that they won't be exposed to more air pollution. This is Philip Davis reporting.
Shareholders of the parent company of the Boston Globe have approved a $1.1 billion takeover of the paper by the New York Times. Shareholders of the Times also have approved the agreement, the largest in U.S. newspaper history. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Some people assume there is one feminist stance on the issue of pornography. In fact, there's a big split on the issue among feminists. On one extreme is my guest, Catherine MacKinnon. MacKinnon is a lawyer who has co-written anti-pornography laws, which were considered and finally defeated or overturned in Minneapolis, Cambridge, Los Angeles, and Bellingham. Under her ordinances, anyone hurt as a result of pornography could sue the producer of the pornography. Her arguments are sometimes very dense, but on the other hand, she doesn't mince words when describing her fears about the impact of pornography. In her new book, Only Words, she writes, the message in pornography is, quote, addressed directly to the penis, delivered through an erection, and taken out on women in the real world. MacKinnon is a professor of law at the University of Michigan Law School. She was instrumental in taking sexual harassment issues into the courtroom, defining sexual harassment as the violation of civil rights. I asked her what kind of pornography she would like to outlaw.
Well, Andrea Dworkin and I, as you know, have written ordinances that have been considered in around the world. And what they do is define pornography the way the pornographers define it. And how we define it is sexually explicit materials that subordinate women through pictures or words, materials into which women are coerced, materials that are forced on women, on children, sometimes on men, materials that actually directly cause assaults, and materials that contribute to the second-class citizenship and subordination of women throughout the society. And anything that is that is pornography. It has to be proven to do that, or it isn't pornography. So in direct answer to your question, nothing that satisfies that definition should be existing in society.
How do you define subordinating women?
It has to be proven as an actual fact. It can be proven, presumably, I would think, we do think, I have yet to find anyone who is at least willing to say they don't agree, that if a woman is coerced into pornography, that she is being subordinated. If someone is being raped or assaulted or molested, presumably they also, and according to our design of our law, are being subordinated.
So when you talk about subordination, are we talking about what happens on screen or what happens behind, you know, behind the camera to the woman who is acting in the film?
Well, many women who are acting only to the degree that they are forced to present themselves as if they are having a good time. In other words, the pleasure is acting. And the rest of it is real. The violence is real. The violence is not acting. So subordination includes both the situations that force women into pornography such that they are then forced to look as though they are enjoying themselves so you don't see the coercion on screen. And it also includes when the coercion is on screen, when women are being bound, tied, tortured, have hot wax dripped on them, burned, cut, all of that. That is on screen. That is sex in the pornography, and you know that's a form of subordination as well. So some of it is clearly present in the materials, and some of it is not, as, for example, the film Deep Throat. What you have actually happening there is throat rape. The woman, Linda, so-called Lovelace, in that film, was actually being coerced, but the coercion was not on screen.
What would you make of a sexually explicit film in which violence was not being done to the woman, but she was engaged in explicit, graphic sexual acts of intercourse or oral sex with a man? Would that be... How would that fit into your definition of either coercion or subordination or pornography?
Well, if women were coerced into it, as they are into those films on a daily basis, then the woman who was coerced into it under our law would have the possibility of bringing a legal claim, not only against a civil claim for sex discrimination against the people who did that to her, but also to stop the film, which at this point in time is protected speech. If the women who are in the films are either unavailable or they say that they couldn't, they don't believe they could prove that they were coerced, or following the pimp's line, they are saying that they were freely there, and or if they experience themselves sincerely to be there as an act of free choice, then obviously there's no action for coercion because the only person who can bring that is the person who's in it. However, regardless of the conditions of production, those materials that you have described are often used to coerce other women into sex acts. They're used by men who get themselves up for their rapes as a as a result and through the direct use of those films. They use them to figure out what kind of women they want to go rape. They use them to get themselves excited and aroused, which they then go and find a woman to rape and so on. So again, regardless of the conditions of production, other women can be hurt by materials like that. Those women would then have a legal claim, not against the woman in the film, but against those who produced it and those who are profiting from it.
So even if a movie just depicts graphically depicts sexual intercourse or oral sex, if someone claimed that that depiction incited a man to have coerced sex with another woman, that
other woman would have to prove that it was because of that film that she was raped. All we are asking for in this law is to give women access to court to prove the connection between pornography and their abuse.
Let me see what you would call this, a movie of explicit sex in which one woman is humiliated or subjugated, but it's a lesbian sex film. The subjugator and the person being, you know, humiliated are both women. Or a similar scenario, it's a man who is the subjugator and the person who's being humiliated is another man.
Yeah,
same-sex S&M films, are they pornography? How would you define that? Would anybody be liable? Would anybody
be the
victim?
I mean, our law is designed so that when people are violated on the basis of sex, our law is written for them to use. Our law does not discriminate against gays and lesbians when they're abused. It doesn't create a separate category and say, okay, fine, you can go abuse women and men so long as you have people of the same sex doing it.
This might be an old, tired example, but I'm sure that there have been psychopathic killers who have been...
Then they're psychopaths.
Wait, let me finish. I'm sure there have been killers who see themselves as having taken inspiration from the Old Testament. Do you know what I mean?
It's not sexually explicit, so it's not covered. If they're psychopaths, then their psychopathology caused their rape, and the pornographers have a defense, and they'll use them as witnesses. It's not the pornography that caused the rape.
How in the world can you prove that pornography caused a rape or that...
Watch us. Just give us a chance. I mean, we have witness after witness. We have piles and piles of bodies here of women and children and some men who are sexually violated under conditions that if they are believed, there will be no problem. We have women in emergency rooms who say that... who are there for rape of the throat. They were nearly suffocated and killed. And the thing they remember is the men saying, let's deep throat her before she passes out. Now, that's evidence against the film Deep Throat. There are young girls who have testified to their brothers bringing in the pornography, holding it up, and their brothers and all their friends holding her down, positioning her exactly according to the pornography, her legs like this, her mouth like that, her arms like this. Now say these things. Now smile. Look like this. They gang rape her. They turn the page. They turn the girl. They make her do it exactly patterned precisely after each and everything in the materials. Now, you know, if existing law requires an awful lot less than that in most cases to show a cause and effect relationship.
Law Professor Catherine McKinnon is my guest. Her new book, Only Words, collects her recent essays on pornography and sexual harassment. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Catherine McKinnon.
As a lawyer, I'm sure you must always be thinking about precedent. What kind of precedent do you think this would set for not only people in pornography, but for people who are making any kind of movie or writing any kind of fiction that takes a violent turn in it and somebody commits a murder that or a rape that might seem to be inspired by that text? I mean, do you see the possibility of filmmakers and fiction writers being held liable for actions that other people commit that somebody might say was inspired by their work?
Well, at this point, sexually explicit, and I think this is going to be generally true, sexually explicit materials that combine, particularly that combine sex with violence and aggression, have effects that are broad in scale, that are immediate in consequence, and that are without regard to predisposing factors, essentially.
What makes...
In other words, there is a clear distinction to be made between pornography and the other kinds of materials that you're mentioning, such that it wouldn't really be precedent for that.
So you want to have a completely separate category of speech for pornography. Keep that separate from everything else.
We don't particularly call it speech. We call it pornography because it is distinct from everything else. The industry is distinct. It's an industry of organized crime. The product is distinct. It's sold in specific places to specific people in specific ways. Everybody knows this. There is just a conspiracy to fog it over by the people who want to keep it.
In the world of civil liberties activists, it's understood that you protect free speech, mm-hmm. even if that speech is vile, like a Nazi march in Skokie.
Right, but an awful lot of speech never gets to be expressed as a result of women being silenced, including by things like pornographers and Nazis marching in Skokie.
Explain what you mean.
Well, hate propaganda and pornography themselves have a tremendous silencing effect on their targets. Sexual abuse shuts you up but good for most of your life. The existing laws that we have for speech only protect that speech which manages to get itself expressed. I'm just saying access to speech as an affirmative matter is something that we need equality thinking about. We need equal access to speech, and we don't have it. What we have instead is protection for those who violate other people's equality across the board, including their equal access to speech, and shut people up. In other words, the rights are all on the wrong side, and the people who are protecting the First Amendment are most often found in the name of the First Amendment protecting pimps, that is, pornographers, Klansmen, Nazis, you know, as if the vilest, as you put it, speech. Well, it isn't the most vile speech. It is the most unequal speech. That's what it is. And they are the ones who are being protected. Instead of finding the most unequal people in this society and figuring out what it's going to take to protect their speech.
You've used the expression First Amendment fundamentalists. Mm-hmm. What do you describe as a First Amendment fundamentalist?
Anybody who's unable to get their mind out of the rut that it's been placed in, socially speaking, that anything which falls into the so-called category speech must be protected no matter how much harm it does, without recognizing that they themselves recognize a whole array of exceptions to that.
Such as?
Exceptions to it, child pornography. All they are is pictures. Now, for the longest time, the First Amendment fundamentalists fetishized that too and said, this must be protected. We must have this, or we won't have the National Geographic, or we won't have sex education books for children. Finally, a law was passed that basically said child pornography is child abuse. If you use a child to make a sex picture, you have abused a child. And those pictures, therefore, not just the so-called acts, but the pictures, the materials, are a traffic in children. And in order to get at the abuse of those children, you can restrict the traffic in the materials that are the incentive for their abuse.
But women aren't children. I mean, with children, there's a sense of they're underage. They're too young to
that
understand
is, they
what
are
they're doing
unequal.
Or to give legal. Yeah.
Right. They are unequal on the basis of age, as well as age and sex. Okay? And I'm saying for purposes of describing First Amendment fundamentalism only, the same argument applies with regard to women who are unequal on the basis of sex. The question is, does their abuse, when it is abuse, matter? Or does only the so-called speech made from their abuse matter?
Law Professor Catherine McKinnon is my guest. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Hillary Clinton testified on the health care plan today before the Ways and Means Committee. Linda Wertheimer is with us. Linda, what will you have on that, on All Things Considered?
We were following it during the day, and we will have a story on it tonight, and we'll also be joined on the show by Senator Chafee of Rhode Island, who is leading the charge for the Republican version of the health care plan. Also, following up on President Clinton's speech at the United Nations on the United Nations interventions around the world, we will be talking about Somalia, about Bosnia, Sylvia Poggioli is in Sarajevo, and about Haiti. Also, we'll have some music from Mali, Alla Farka Torre.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guest is Catherine McKinnon. Her new book, Only Words, collects her recent essays on pornography and sexual harassment. I want to move on now to work that you're doing representing women who have been raped in the war in Bosnia. What are you doing with them?
Well, I was asked by them to get them some form of justice, to try to stop the genocidal atrocities that are being committed against them and other women. And children and men, and to try to get some form of recovery from a declaration that what they're doing is a genocidal atrocity, that it is a war crime, as it clearly in law is, but that it is being actually committed against them, and all the way through to some kind of reparations.
Where are you legally now?
Legally, we have brought an action on behalf of the Bosnian women. I'm also representing Croatian women. But on behalf of the Bosnian survivors, an action against Radovan Karadzic, the leader of the Bosnian Serbs, against him in New York for genocide, including for the rapes that are genocide, the forced prostitution, the forced pregnancies, the sexual mutilations, all the sex and ethnic discrimination that he has unleashed by orders and licensed, in fact, ordered his army to commit.
What kind of precedent are you hoping to create?
We want to create, and this is why I was hired explicitly by all the women over there, a precedent that recognizes that rape violates women's human rights. Whether in war, whether in peace, whether in the United States or anywhere else, that women have a human right not to be raped. And what we've also found is that pornography is being made of those rapes.
You mean that people are actually filming it?
Yes, they are actually filming it.
In Bosnia?
Yes, the rapes in Bosnia, in some of the rape death camps, And there is also reports that some of the mass exterminations are in the process of being filmed. I think it would be very surprising if these films did not turn up on the pornography market, where, in fact, they would be difficult to distinguish from everything that is already there.
Hearing about this, what a horrible thought that mm-hmm. films are actually being made of rapes in Bosnia.
They're actually being made of rapes in Los Angeles, too.
Don't you feel the need to distinguish between films that are actually made of genuine rape and films that are made from actors who maybe aren't working under the best circumstances, but it's not rape? Do you know what I'm saying?
I know what you're trying to say.
You wouldn't agree that it's possible to make a pornography film without it being rape?
What I think prostitution is serial rape. It is sex the woman isn't choosing to have for the sex. She's being coerced by the money, or she's being coerced by something else. Generally speaking, that is prostitution. Pornography is an arm of prostitution. It is a technologically sophisticated traffic in women. And what's going on in these rape death camps is also organized serial rape, otherwise as a war crime called enforced prostitution. Now, that's happening under conditions of as sex and ethnic discrimination there, captive, abducted women being kept under conditions that they cannot get out of. It's called sexual slavery. Now, the fact it's happening under conditions of war means that there are laws against it that recognize it as a war crime. What I think needs to be recognized is that whenever and wherever it happens, it's a crime against the humanity of women, whether it's so-called peacetime or any other time.
So you don't feel you're mixing together two really separate things here?
No, what I feel is that the rapes in Bosnia are real to people. And praise the goddess that sometime, finally, the rapes in Bosnia, it took Bosnia, it took genocide, it took the press saying these rapes are real rapes for people to believe that they're real. Now what we need to see is the way in which the very same thing happens under other conditions, but it is rape. It is still real rape.
I think we'll have to leave it there. We're out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
Catherine McKinnon's new book is called Only Words. She's a professor of law at the University of Michigan Law School. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlease, research assistance from Peter Clowney. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Now that Israel and the PLO have signed an agreement on the Gaza Strip and Jericho, what is the future of Palestinians in Jordan? On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with journalist Rami Khoury. He's a Palestinian-Jordanian and is a columnist for the Jordan Times in Amman. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.